The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, and welcome those of you here to IMC. Thank you for coming, and thank you for coming and wearing your masks. Now that I think the two places closest to us, two counties now, have one of the fastest surging of COVID in the country, even San Francisco and Santa Cruz. I'm going to Santa Cruz today. I think Santa Cruz has the highest, at least in California. So I'm going down there for the next 2 weeks to teach a retreat. And the retreat topic is on my mind. Usually retreats have themes that we make up just before the retreat starts to kind of tie the teachings, the practice together. And so I kind of want to do it, maybe for my sake, a trial run. It's kind of what's on my mind. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about this and tell you in a few minutes what the actual theme is. But first, I would like to tell a story from my life when I was a Zen student, and that'll be illustrative of what I'm going to say more of. So I lived at a Green Gulch Zen Center in Marin County for a while, and as a new student there, so I would go in many times a day into the meditation hall. It was a big, very big. It used to be a very big barn that they converted, high ceiling and big rectangular building. And the way it was laid out, you'd kind of go in from the back door, and you would go into the room and down some steps, and you'd come at the back of the altar, and then you'd either go left and right and go to sit in the main part of the room. And so there was an aisle then behind the altar. And if you were on the left side of the room and you wanted to go to the right side of the room, you would always walk behind the altar. The rule was you never walked across the middle of the room in front of the altar. I think the idea that the Buddha was in the altar and it was disrespectful to walk in front of the Buddha. And so you would always walk all the way around. And if you were in the deepest end of the meditation hall and you wanted to get to the other, you know, just two, 3 feet on the other side of that magical invisible line, you have to walk all the way around to get there. And as I was there, sometimes there were reasons, variety of reasons to doing things, whatever we did there in the room, that I would get close to that line, midline, right down in the middle of the Buddha's body, you know. And I could feel, my body would feel, I was approaching like a magnetic field or this force field as I approached that line. And my body, what these little micro muscles in my body would be pulling me away or be activated. And so that inner, it wasn't conscious all this, but it was kind of subconscious that I was doing this. And so this feelings I had in my body, these micro muscles and excited energy that would come or something, as I approached that line, it kind of contributed to the sense of there's a force field here. And so I would, and the closer I got, I'd feel more of this force field. And then I would pull back. And so that went on for a long time, but I didn't think about it too much, just what was. And then one day, I think I was cleaning in the back behind the altar, I was cleaning. And there were some tourists who came. There's people who just wandered off the street and were just kind of walking around to see what a Zen center was like. And they wandered into the meditation hall. And they just wandered in and walked around and walked right through that line. And nothing happened. No lightning struck. They didn't get electrocuted. And nothing happened. And at that moment, I realized that line was just a figment of my imagination. I mean, I was told not to cross the midline, but the sense of a force field, the sense of this, you know, how my whole relationship to this line was just, didn't exist. You know, the line didn't exist, and my relationship was something imaginary to this. It just all was made up by the mind, and I'd lived what was made up in my mind as a thing didn't really exist, but it had an impact on me, and I behaved accordingly. So that was kind of fascinating to see, you know, how the mind can project onto reality things that are not there, and live as if it's there. And to some degree, we do that with people. We project power sometimes, or qualities onto people that may not be there. Sometimes we up the amplitude, maybe, of some of these qualities in people and make them bigger than they are. And it's not uncommon for people to go spend time with a spiritual teacher. Especially if the teacher has, if they're really, you know, elevated importance in people's minds. And then just being in the presence of the teacher is like, wow, I'm in this wonderful field, this force field, this wonderful field of the teacher. And there might be a few things coming from the teacher, but it's elevated because of the same phenomena. The mind is projecting and imagining and living as if this is real, rather than not appreciating how much the mind is contributing to it and assigning it to the teacher, for example. It's all kinds of things. So this idea that the mind will contribute to through its imagination to project onto reality things that are not there, or not there in the way that we're living them, is a very important principle to understand the Buddha's teachings in relationship to ourselves. Because we do it to ourselves in different ways. And that's kind of the theme of this retreat we're going to do, where the Buddha talked about five different ways which we create we divide ourselves into five different ways, and each of those divisions, by dividing us, we're dividing the wholeness of who we are. And then we get attached to those divisions. And sometimes we put a lot of value and importance into these divisions. Some people put more importance in one of the divisions, or some of the divisions more than other people do. But that projection, this idea, oh, this is where it's at, this is important, this is where the force field is, this is where I am, this is my sense of who I am. And sometimes the sense of I am, I exist, sometimes is another force field or another something that's kind of the mind has projected onto reality, in this case, the reality of this being here. And we live in that projection in all kinds of complicated ways. And we like it, we don't like it, we don't, you know, we pull away from it, we hold on to it, we cling. And so beginning to appreciate how the mind does that is part of the function of mindfulness practice. The simplest way to, in the Buddha's teachings, to understand this is that he talked about this as being five areas where people cling, they get attached. And these things are, the word for this in Pali, the ancient language, is khanda, khanda, which I think, unfortunately, the most common English translation is aggregates. So if you, aggregates, like, you know, they make cement with aggregates and stuff. And I mean, that doesn't sound very appealing. You have five aggregates and you get attached to them. You know, some of you probably, as soon as you hear that, your mind goes a little bit numb. What are they talking about here? The word khanda also means branches of a tree. So these are five branches. It also means the trunk. It has both meanings, the trunk of a tree and the branches of a tree. So which is really the tree? Is it the trunk? Is it the branch that goes off to the right or the branch that goes off to the left? Which is really the tree? Or is it the leaves at the end of the branches? No. Really, what's the tree is what you can't see. It's the roots underneath. That's really the tree. What's really the tree? If we have five different opinions here of which is really the tree, you could have a war. This is the tree. No, not the tree. And then why decide that any one thing is the tree? Why be attached to this has to be the tree? Why not let the tree just be a tree? So we have these branches, or we make these branches within the wholeness of who we are, and we can live in relationship to those, and we can get attached. So the first one the Buddha talks about is our appearance. The word is rupa, R-U-P-A in Pali, which often is translated as the body, but the word more literally means appearance. It's what one of the meanings is what the eye sees. Like, so if I look down at this bell, the bell is the rupa because it's the sight object, the object of sight. But the fascinating thing about the word appearance is that this appears to be a bell. Is it really a bell? Well, it's functionally it's a bell. But, you know, it could also be a begging bowl. You know, a Buddhist monastic could go around like this in the streets and people would recognize, oh, that's a begging bowl. It could be a spittoon. Some of my Buddhist teachers in Asia had these things about this size right next to them. And it was kind of, you know, fascinating to hear them, middle of a Dharma talk, kind of clear their throat in the loudest possible way and go, you know, and spit into this spittoon. I don't know if, could I get away with that here? So this is an appearance. And so our appearance that we have, our physical appearance, for example, is a big part of it. How our body appears to us. And this is very important to understand how our body appears to us instead of how our body actually is. Because how it appears to us has a lot to do with the choices the mind makes, selects about what's important about ourselves, what we're focusing on. For some people, like when I was a teenager, probably one of the most important appearances that I had that I was attached to was my hair. I had very long hair. I had to worry about split ends. And this was like a big thing, you know, the length of my hair and this and that. And probably during the day, if I was thinking about my appearance, I was mostly thinking about my hair. And that's changed over the years. So some people get very attached to their appearance. And some people, their life is based on their appearance because a lot of their life energy goes into doing that. So I don't know if this is fair, but you know, for example, bodybuilders. Some people are professional bodybuilders, and that has a lot to do with appearance. There might be other reasons to be a bodybuilder, but there are people who are very focused on their physical appearance. Some people are more focused on their beauty or lack of beauty than they are about the words they speak. It's been a lot of time preparing, you know, going out so that we can be beautiful or nice, and going to salons and having the hair made up or this and that. They have beauty contests, and some people, I think, make it their full-time thing for a while too. Go to beauty contests. Some of this thing about the appearance is very painful because our society makes definitions of what's the right way to be in appearance-wise in all kinds of ways, in physical appearance, in skin color, race, height, size, all kinds of things. And so the preoccupation with appearance is not just because people have an inner disposition that way, but society reinforces it with a lot of suffering. But we're still, it's just we end up with this, you know, society participating in creating these force fields in the middle of the meditation hall, the force fields in the middle of our lives that now have heightened importance and value. And all kinds of dysfunctional activity can exist around this kind of thing, around appearance. Some of this concern with appearance is a mind's creation, sometimes a collective creation of many people in a society. And then people get attached to it. And then there's the second thing that the Buddha said, that people select out of the whole, and they choose to highlight, and that is what in English, in Buddhist English, is called feelings, but it's not the emotions, it's the whether things are pleasant or unpleasant. And some people are very focused on pleasure, very focused on pain, and what's not unpleasant. And within reason, it's a reasonable thing for human beings to be concerned with. But, you know, to sit in a chair and be uncomfortable and adjust it, that seems fine. But it's possible to select this thing about comfort and pleasure and make it a primary orientation around how we live our lives. Some people spend much of their day pursuing pleasure, of all kinds of different types, or much of their day activated around feeling pain in some way. Pain is an unfortunate part of life. But to what degree is it selected out by the mind, given more importance than it actually is because of all the associations of what pain means and what's going to happen to me and the imagination into the future? And so pleasure and pain become, for some people, their even a primary orientation in their life. And that's, you know, and so that becomes their force field. That becomes their, what they cling to. And so, and then there's the third one has to do with our perceptions of things, our recognition of things, our ideas of what is. And this is the simplest ideas of things that the mind makes. And some people, their opinions, their stories, their ideas of how things are becomes what's most interesting for them, or most what they're focusing on. Simple ideas of right and wrong. Simple ideas of beauty and ugliness. Simple ideas of roles we have, identities we have. And so having the right ideas, being able to recognize what's happening in terms of the world around us and organizing according to the ideas we have is how some people feel safe, some people find their way. And so some people are very focused on perceptions and ideas and concepts, because concepts is what kind of you need to have in place to be safe or get around. And so some people then are very attached to ideas, to concepts, like a concept of roles, concepts of identity, concepts of, you know, what should be in society and how other people should be. The fourth area the Buddha talked about is the mental, the world, inner mental world, that does all this constructing, that does all this imagining, that does all this prioritization. So when I was in that meditation hall, the mind was imagining this line. The mind was imagining what would happen if I got zapped by walking close to it. And so I was living a deliberate life in relationship to something my mind had created. And so the fourth area was this area of kind of deliberate construction, stories, ideas, intentions, plans, memories and stuff that, you know, complicated inner world that we construct. So the inner constructions that we make. I think stories is a nice way of seeing it. All the inner stories we make and live in. And some people get attached to that. They attach to their memories, attached to ideas of the future. And these loom really big. And for some people, that's where they get kind of bogged down, or there's kind of the it gets things narrowed into that world. And then the fifth one that Buddha talked about, this division of the whole, is the consciousness that is aware of it all the rest of it. That which knows that this is happening. That which knows this is a. This is hearing, this is seeing, this is smelling, this is tasting, this is the tactile sensations. This is the mind activity that I see. And for some people, that's what they get attached to. And people who do a lot of meditation, sometimes they get really attached to consciousness, because that everything else falls away. Everything else you begin to see is rising and passing, coming and going, quiets down. And it doesn't seem like something to be so attached to. But for some people, consciousness seems to be the ultimate thing, the final thing. I'm not all these things. I'm not the world. I'm not my body. I'm not my thoughts. I'm not my beliefs. But we'll select consciousness as a thing to be. This is who I am. And that begins having the projection. That has people orient around that as being important. And it's not some people, their very sense of being existing is invested into consciousness. Oh, consciousness will continue after I die. So it's okay, I'm safe. And so I need to know who I am, and I know that I'm consciousness, and it's very comforting because consciousness is not the world, not the things in the world. So it's a place of safety, it can't be touched. Something like that. So I'm not saying that all ideas like that are wrong. But the point I'm trying to make today is the way in which the whole of who we are gets divided into these different realms. And once that division is made, each of these five branches can be a place of attachment, of clinging. And for the Buddha, it's not that we're supposed to not make these branches necessarily. The Buddha was interested in how we overmake them, have too much focus on them, and then get attached to them. And and for the Buddha, he said that the way people are identified, the way people are apprehended, the way people are observed, is based on where their mind dwells. And if it dwells on any one of these five areas, then people are reckoned or measured or understood by that way. So if you spend a lot of time with your physical appearance, then you're kind of recognized, you're measured by that. Because I've seen people where, wow, that person's really put a lot of work and effort into it. Day after day, work after, that's the person who's really puts a lot of care into their appearance. So that understood that, almost like that becomes their identity. And with each of the other four, when there's a really attached to that, then people, the Buddha said, people are reckoned or understood through that category. So it's not just that we understand ourselves that way, but that's how other people end up understanding them as well. So then we come to this wonderful little teaching in relationship to all this. And then now that I've prepared the ground, the Buddha had a friend who was a king, King Pisenadi. And one day the king wanted to hear some teachings from some really wise person. And the Buddha wasn't around, and some of the other monks weren't around, and so he was asking, who should I go listen to? And one of his advisors said, oh, there's this very wise nun, Buddhist nun, named Kema. Venerable Kema. And she is really wise. You should go visit her. And he said, great, I'll go visit Kema. So he did. And he asked her a question, which I think was a big preoccupation for some other people in ancient India. It's a preoccupation that maybe some of people here in the modern West have as well, is what happens when we die? Do we somehow get reborn? Do we go to heaven? Is there any kind of continuation of us after we die? Or is this life the only thing we have? And you know, and when we die, you know, it's all over. It's done. What is going on here? And so people would come to the Buddha and ask him questions like this. And so the Buddha came to Kema, king came to Kema, and she asked this common question you see in the suttas. So he starts, does the Buddha exist after death? Will the Buddha exist after death? And I think to ask about the Buddha, because the Buddha was kind of one of the most respected spiritual teachers of his time, not just because he had a lot of knowledge, but he had attained something very important, attained the highest states of humanity that they knew of back in ancient India. And so what happens to the Buddha? Maybe, you know, if the Buddha exists after life, that tells me something about what I can expect or something. So does the Buddha exist after death? And the nun, she said, the Buddha has not declared this. The Buddha has not claimed that he exists after death. Then, Reverend Lady, does the Buddha not exist after death? Great King, the Buddha has not declared this either. Then, Reverend Lady, does the Buddha both exist and not exist after death? Great King, the Buddha has not declared this. Then, Reverend Lady, does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death? Great King, the Blessed One has not declared this. And the king is a little bit exasperated, like that's all the possibilities there are. So, you know, how does this work? What's going on here? And so she says to the king, well, I will ask you a question about the same matter. Answer it as you see fit. What do you think, great king? Do you have an accountant or a calculator or a mathematician who can count the grains of sand in the river Ganges thus? There are so many grains of sand. There are so many hundreds of grains of sand. There are so many hundreds of thousands of grains of sand. And the king says, no, I don't have anyone who can count all the grains of sand. Do you have an accountant or calculator or mathematician who can count the water in the great ocean thus? There are so many gallons of water. There are so many hundreds of thousands of gallons of water. No, Reverend Lady, for what reason? Because the great ocean is deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom. So too, Great King, that form, that appearance by which one describing the Buddha might describe him, has been abandoned by the Buddha, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, so that there's no more subject to future arising. The Tathagata, great king, is liberated from reckoning in terms of appearance. He is deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom, like the great ocean. And then he does the same thing with these other five branches. That people will measure or see the Buddha by appearance, by feelings, by perceptions, by these mental constructions and the consciousness, but that the Buddha has cut off. Now, if we understand that these are really parts of who we are, what do you mean? And cut off appearance, cut off feelings, cut off perceptions, construct. I mean, that's who we are, isn't it? So that's just, then you don't exist. I think how I understand this is the Buddha has let go of any clinging and any constructing of these force fields, of these lines in the meditation hall in relationship to ourselves. The Buddha is not creating a sense of self idea through what we would call appearances. It's not involved in the world of appearances in an ordinary way. Not involved in creating importance and creating a world around feelings, around perceptions, around stories and mental constructions, and even around consciousness. There's some dramatic way in which that tendency of human beings has been let go, put aside. And in doing so, what is the Buddha? And the nun says, he is deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom like the great ocean. So maybe that's who you are. Hard to fathom like the deep ocean. Like, you know, we have climate change and drought here in California, and technology improves and they're learning to harvest electricity from the tides and the waves. At some point, we might move underwater. That's the only place we'll survive. And then what we'll do is we divide property here in the Bay Area. You know, people have, live in properties, and some people live on properties that are 500 square feet, some bigger, so imagine that everyone will divide up the ocean into maybe 1 acre blocks, square, 1 acre square, and we'll all buy squares in the ocean, and we'll have our underwater home in our square. And people in the future will say, what's the ocean? Oh, the ocean is this place that's built by all these blocks of properties. And they always have these lines in them, and those lines, people fight over the lines, and they get surveyors to come and get the right line, and how could you have crossed my line? And above me there's people, below there's people, because we have these blocks, right? We've divided up the ocean. Is that what the ocean is? Blocks of property owned? Right now, we have this beautiful nearby for us here, the Pacific. Deep, immeasurable. I go to the ocean sometimes, the edge of it, and watch, and I marvel that it's been there for a long time. Humans come and go, civilizations come and go, and those waves have been lapping up on the shore, kind of. The waves have been crossing the ocean for billions of years, and the depth of it has been there for a long time. It's deep. It's immeasurable. What a sad thing it'd be if we divided up into these lines and blocks and think that that's real and fight over it. What if our lives, what if we allow our lives to be immeasurable, undivided, not attached to these things? For the Buddha, his freedom was to no longer live in these branches, like with one branch being the tree, but maybe being just the whole tree, or maybe not even the tree. Is the tree separate from the soil, from the other trees, the birds that come to it, the nests that grow in it? Is it separate from the clouds and the rain that comes down and the temperature and the sun? Is it necessary to divide the world? Before humans came along, was it divided? certainly functionally it makes sense to divide, and I think it's human minds will divide to find their food and eat and find the toilet, because if you don't, it's a mess. But the so it has some usefulness. But do we cling to it? Do we add more that's needed? And is there a way of living in an undivided world where we are undivided with it as well? Immeasurable, deep, where we cannot be reckoned, because to reckon who we are is to make a invisible, constructed line down the middle of something. So is there another way of living and being? So one of the functions of this meditation practice is to help us put to rest, at least temporarily, some of the divisions we live under, some of the ideas and constructs and prioritizations and choices we make. This is important. This is what it's about. And to have an experience of, I want to say ourselves, but even not even of ourselves, just an experience of being alive that doesn't have to be defined by anything. It doesn't have to select anything from the suchness, the fullness, the wholeness of whatever it's here. And what a big difference it is to know that that's possible. To know that this too is a refuge. It puts a little question mark behind the way we normally live our lives, so that we don't give too much importance to it. It's important. Our life is important. We care for others through some of these divisions. So it's, but to not reify them, not solidify them, not that it has to be this way, but to be fluid and free, and to pick up some of the divisions, some of the ideas, pragmatically, functionally, when they're useful, and be ready to drop them and when they're not useful. To live a life. So this division, these five divisions, is one of the very important teachings of the Buddha. Because this is, for the Buddha, this is the areas where people cling. And if we want to be free, we let go of that clinging. And who are you when you've let go of clinging like that? That the Buddha doesn't declare. He's not going to tell you who you are. Isn't that great? Just like he doesn't tell people who he is. And maybe if you allow me to tell you a little bit who you are, maybe then you're whole. And whole with what? Whole with the whole. What is the whole? I don't know. But we find out by not making it into anything. So may you maybe reflect a little bit about this teaching, and maybe there are ways that you also live with imagined lines down the middle of your life that have had some influence on you, or force field on you, or something, that maybe, you know, someone will snap the fingers and poof, you realize, wait a minute, that doesn't really exist. And maybe you can be free. So thank you very much. And one announcement I have is that next week, because I'm on retreat for these next 2 weeks, we have a guest teacher coming, a Vanessa Abel is her name. She's a wonderful Zen priest from the local Zen center in Kanando in Mountain View. And I've gotten to know her because she's been very much involved with and supporting and kind of almost a colleague with the trainings at my involvement with Buddhist chaplaincy. I train people in Buddhist chaplaincy, and she's been involved in this world. And so she's a wonderful person that I think you're in for a treat when she comes next week, if you're here. So, thank you.